All right, welcome back. Thank you guys so much for joining us for another of our deep dive segments. And our guest today has been on with us several times. And he and I haven't spoken since we started doing this segment. But, without further ado, let me announce who we're with here. We've got Brent Johnson of Santiago Capital with us. Brent, how are you?
I'm good, man. How are you doing?
Doing good, man. It's good to get you back on and talk to you. So we started, had several requests to do kind of a deeper dive segment. As you know, you've been on with us several times. The whole point of the show is taking the more complex financial issues and making them distill them down to the point where they're not so esoteric, right? It's broader, you know, more accessible for those that don't do this for a living and stare at screens all day like you and I do.
Sure.
And so one of the first thoughts I had when we started doing this, Brent, was I wanted to get you on in this format and kind of go unhandcuffed for the first time and just kind of let it rip. And of course, we got to talk about the dollar. But before we get to that, I wanted to talk to you about some things that I thought I heard you talking about in a recent can't remember if it was an interview. I think it was an interview that I heard you in. Could have been Twitter. But you were talking about being a risk manager and a fiduciary for your clients. And I thought that was really interesting, Brent, because, you know, you get to the peaks of bull markets or you get to lofty places like we are. And I'm sure like you or like me, you're looking at prospective or new client portfolios all the time. And Brent, I'm alarmed at what I see. There is no risk management going on, and I think it's so important, especially for the older clients, the ones that are nearing retirement or in retirement, what they need, and I thought what you said was so prescient and so on point, what they really need is a risk manager, right? What, they don't need to outperform the S&P every quarter. They need to finance the rest of their life. Right. Those are two very different things. I wanted to hear your thoughts on that and elaborate on that because you didn't go deeply into that. But I could tell by the thought by your comments that you thought about it a lot. And I have as well. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that and dive a little deeper into that and hear exactly what you meant when you talked about people need a risk manager.
Sure. Well, there's several different parts to this, so I'll try to kind of walk through them in somewhat of a way that will make sense without jumping around too much. But I think the first thing is you kind of have to understand what it is you're trying to accomplish. And that's both from a manager standpoint, like me, and from an investor standpoint, like, you know, a client or you or somebody else. And once you've kind of have that figured out, then that is going to influence what you do next. Now, that sounds kind of obvious, but I think many people make the mistake of trying to do what everybody else is trying to do or using the same benchmark that everybody else is trying to use or competing with somebody else on returns, even though you don't necessarily have the same goals, you don't have the same mandates, you don't have the same needs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so when you hear all these, you know, things, you know, well, what are you up or down versus the S&P? What are your returns year to date? And the assumption is automatically that if you have a higher return year to date, that you have somehow done better than the other person. Well, on an absolute basis, just looking at the number, then sure. But you don't know what the risk level that one person's willing to take versus what another person's willing to take.
Right.
The other thing is if you're kind of a young person starting out, you have a good job and you don't necessarily have a lot of responsibilities yet and you have some excess income, you can afford to take more. I would argue you can afford to take more risk.
Agreed.
Because you have less responsibilities, you have a longer time horizon to make up any losses, you don't have to worry about impairing your retirement when you're still 30 or 40 years away from retirement. So I would argue that that person should have a different benchmark or a different goal than somebody who's 55 or 60 or 65 or whatever the number is. And then, you know, it also starts to play into a little bit of, you know, which asset class are you in? Are you in, or what's going to happen next? Like the whole inflation, deflation, should it be in gold? Should it be in Bitcoin? And the thing is, you know, I think everybody gets caught up a little bit in being right and trying to figure out where to place all their assets. And the reality is you don't have to choose. You don't have to choose one or the other. Because I think to a certain extent, I don't know if this is a function of social media and seeing what everybody else is doing and the keeping up with the Joneses and da, 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 da. I feel like we've gotten into this hyper-competitive all or nothing. You're either a genius or an idiot. You know, there's no middle ground. And as a result, you have to, whatever it is you decide is going to happen, you have to go all in on that. And the reality is you don't have to go all in it. You don't have to pick and choose. You can do a little bit of everything. You can be diversified. And then as you gain more clarity or as things, you know, as you see opportunities along the way, then you can, you know, overweight or underweight. But I feel like, I don't know if I'm answering your question here or not.
No, you are. Yeah. Well, it's kind of an amorphous topic. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel, I just feel like everybody is hyper certain on whatever thesis they have is right now. And I've said this before. I've been saying it a lot lately just because I find it psychologically, or I find it interesting from a psychological perspective and from a market perspective and from a potential return and a risk perspective. But I feel like all the different groups I talk to, and I just alluded to this a minute ago, but I talk to a lot of people in the gold world. I talk to a lot of people in the crypto world. I talk to a lot of people who are equity bulls. I talk to a lot of people who are equity bears, and talk to a lot of people who are bond bulls. So I feel like I talk to a pretty good representation of kind of the major asset classes. And what's amazing to me is for the most part, everybody I talk to is absolutely certain that they know how it's going to play out. And they've picked the asset class that they are in. So the crypto guys are all in on crypto, right? The gold guys are all in on gold. And the inflationists are all in on inflationary assets. The deflationists are all in on bonds or cash or whatever it is. And the guy that I talked to, there's a really smart guy that I talk to, you know, every week, at least once a week. We have a call every Friday. And literally for a year and a half, I think he's probably outperformed everybody over the last year and a half. And every week for the last year and a half, he has said, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm really not sure. And
yep.
do you know what I mean?
Like 100%.
I find that refreshing because he doesn't necessarily think he's a genius. He thinks, you know, he has a process that he uses. He has, you know, he has owned equities for a long time. He's bought puts along the way here and there where he thought he needed them. For the most part, the puts haven't paid off. But the equities that he owns have more than made up for them. He has cash on the sidelines that he uses opportunistically. You know, he owned some commodities last fall, and, you know, he started to kind of pare that down, you know, this spring. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and whenever I would ask him, you know, what do you think is going to happen next, he would always answer, well, you know, I'm not sure. It's just really kind of uncertain. He would tell me his reasonings for what he was doing here and there, but he would never say, yeah, this is, and this looks great. You
know? Yeah.
He would never come out with any certainty. And I kind of appreciated that, to be honest.
Well, 100%. And I've said a couple times on that line, I put out a couple tweets talking about certainty being the hallmark of a charlatan, meaning how in the world are you certain of anything in this environment? And if you tell me you are, that's the only way that I feel like I can differentiate the people that I want to listen to and the people that are a waste of time is by the people that are certain of anything, just because it's complete nonsense. And we've been in, we've had an outstanding performance over the last 2 years, and I'm not saying that to stick my chest out at all. I've had bad years too, and I've been really open about that. If you do this business, you don't win all the time. Mm-hmm. And Brent, you know how we've done it? We literally have some of every single thing you mentioned. We've traded some Bitcoin really well. We have some gold that's done well. We've got some inflationary assets. We've got some tech and growth. You know, because you don't know what's going to happen. And this level of certainty, this all or nothing, I'm reminded by your back and forth with the crypto guys. I sit there and look at that and go, do you guys realize that you are unveiling yourselves to be nothing more than rank amateurs? Like, when you manage other people's money, even if you're right, you should be fired for putting them 30% in crypto or 50%. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's ludicrous. It's almost to a point where when you invest like that, if you've got that all or nothing type of philosophy, it really doesn't matter to me what the outcome is, because the outcome eventually will be really bad.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
If you're going all in on the asset class, hope it works, but eventually it won't. You're going to get it wrong. And when you do, what does that look like?
That's right. And I think what you're starting to highlight here, too, is important. Because I think on the one hand, the rise of Twitter and Instagram and the ability to, you know, host your own podcast, as an example, self-publish, the ability to self-publish, you know, the rise of the ability to self-publish over the last 10 to 20 years, on the one hand, is incredibly powerful and beneficial, right?
Yeah.
Because you get to, if you care enough to do any level of research at all, you have the ability to search out diverse opinions and, you know, get fantastic information, right? And so from that perspective, I think that's a real benefit. There is a downside to it, though, is that you have to understand, you have to, when you listen to somebody talk, you have to first understand, who are they talking to? In other words, you might listen to a brilliant commodity trader,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And he might make a lot of sense, but, you know, he might be giving a speech to a bunch of farmers. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, farmers might have different concerns than you do. They might have different risks than you do. They might have different timelines than you do. So even though it's a great speech and even though it's fantastic information that's being given, it doesn't necessarily apply to you.
Right.
Right. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is you have to understand who they're talking to. And then I think the other thing is you have to understand that person's not just the objective for sort of speech, because I'm not saying that person might be up there trying to sell you a bill of goods, but he might just be talking about one thing, but that doesn't mean that he himself is 100% all in on that one thing. And I'm going to give you a very good example, and I'm going to use myself as that example. Everybody who's heard me talk before knows that I believe that the dollar is going to go higher.
And that is why you're 100% right. Invested in dollars, right?
Exactly. All I own is dollars and calls on the dollar index. And because the dollar's gone down 10% over the last year, you know, we've lost everything. And it's just a smiling heap, a smoking heap of ashes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, that's the thing. You know, again, it gets back to this all or nothing thing. I have a high level of confidence that before it's all said and done, I will be right.
Mm-hmm.
I think in order to be a successful investment manager or risk manager, you have to have confidence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can be kind of willy-nilly, shy, da-da-da-da, and then place other people's capital at risk and hope to be successful, right?
Yeah, scared money doesn't make money.
Right, exactly. Now, the flip side of that, though, is I am also, because I'm a fiduciary and because I know I'm not perfect as much as I would like to be, right? And I know that anybody who is 100% confident is the market's going to teach them a lesson, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, so I talk about the dollar a lot because I feel like most people don't think it's important, or that most people are 100% sure that it's going to zero because money printer go burr, right?
Yep.
And I feel like I'm one of the only people who continues to talk about it. And if there wasn't someone like me or a few of my kind of compatriots doing it, it would just, everybody would be on the other side of the boat, which I think a lot of them already are. You know, most of them are on the other side of the boat, and perhaps everybody on that side of the boat will be right. But because I think that if I am right, the risks to the market are so enormous that I can't ignore it, right?
Yep.
So even if I, and what other thing people don't really realize is that me and my clients will probably be better off if I'm wrong.
Right. No, no, right. Right. Yes. I was telling a client of mine that the other day.
Right. Right. And so I know I'm jumping around here a little bit, but the point I'm trying to make with all of this is, if you're out there and you're concerned about, you know, where we're at and where we're going, and you're having a tough time figuring out whether the inflation camp is right or the deflation camp is right, or if the dollar bulls or if the dollar bears or if the Fed or the ECB, who's going to make the mistake. If you're having trouble kind of figuring that all out, relax, because you don't have to figure it all out.
No, no.
You can position your portfolio in a way that you will at least survive whatever comes. And that's, I think, that we are in this fourth turning environment. And, you know, I know what the fourth turning is. And I think that's probably become a pretty popular book over the last couple of years, even though it was written 10 or 15 years ago now. But the fourth turning is this concept that, you know, you go through these historical periods where, you know, you have the spring where everything is great, and then you get into the summer and you start to reap the harvest of all your investments. And then you get into the fall and it starts to get a little gray and some storm clouds on the horizon. And then you get into the winter and there's kind of some of this big upheaval, right?
Mm-hmm.
And each of these turnings take anywhere from 15 to 30 years. And so a full four turnings take, you know, a generation. And I kind of feel like we're in this fourth turning environment. And the thing about fourth turnings is that they are incredibly uncertain. They are incredibly scary and dark, and, you know, all kinds of unimagined things happen. And it's a great turnover of kind of the establishment into the new awakening of the spring. And I'm, because I know that historically these fourth turnings are so uncertain, I think it's rather funny that so many people are certain, right?
Oh God, yeah. Now, there's a part of me, Brent, there's a part of me that's jealous of them, right? Just because I'm sitting there going, "Look, I know that your certainty is going to blow up in your face,
yeah.
But man, it must feel good." And I really wish I had it. I just don't.
I think it depends, right? If you're absolutely certain that crypto is going to win, you've been feeling pretty good, right?
Yeah.
If you're absolutely certain that gold is going to win, it's been kind of a rough ride.
Right?
If you're absolutely certain that equities are going to win, well, you know, that's been a nice ride for the last 12 months or 15 months. But, you know, the first quarter of last year wasn't so good.
Right.
And by the way, I have to apologize. I don't know if you can hear it, but somebody's working on their apartment right above me. They just started jackhammering. So
it's barely a little hum. I just figured you were blowing up an air mattress. That's what it sounded like to me.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
Just
yeah.
Getting comfortable. I get it.
Yeah.
No, you know, that's great stuff, man. And I love your thoughts on that, because, you know, and people will probably laugh because I feel like I can turn anything back to football or golf, they're great examples, great microcosms of life. But there was a scene, and I think about this all the time. I remember thinking about it last year going through the COVID thing, thought about it. I think about it all the time. There's a scene in Friday Night Lights in the final game where the star running back, Boobie Miles, is hurt, and they got the kid in there that is Tim McGraw's son in the movie. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the star running back pulls him aside and he goes, "Quit fighting it, roll with it." You know, because he had fumbling problems. And he said, "You don't want to fumble, loosen up, roll with it. You want to keep moving downfield, but it doesn't have to be in a straight line. You don't have to run everybody over." And I feel like that's like being an asset manager, right? We know the direction we're heading. We know where we're trying to go, but we should know that it's going to be anything but a straight line. And what our job to do is not to fumble and roll with it. Just keep moving it down, right? Keep matriculating it down the field. And you don't have to get it all in one play. You know, that idea of rolling with it, does that resonate to you?
Oh, absolutely. No question. And again, I think it kind of depends on where you're at in life.
Yeah, 100%.
If you're 20 years old, you know, I would encourage people to roll the dice a little bit.
Yeah.
Take a higher level of risk. You know, follow your passions. You know, take some, you know, if you see a great opportunity, go all in on it and try to change the world, so to speak. But, you know, if you're in retirement or moving towards retirement, if you've got five little kids that you have to take care of, you perhaps don't have the ability to take that same level of downside, right? And while it would be nice to be able to do so, you know, maybe that's just not a possibility for you. And so, and you don't have to feel bad about that, right? If, you know, if you have to play it closer to the vest than your buddy who's all in on, you know, gold or crypto or whatever it is, don't feel bad about it. If one of them is not better than the other, it's just different.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing with regards to managers and people who are, you know, market commentators, et cetera, there might be a guy out there or a woman out there who has been running a portfolio averaging 7% a year for the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, right? And there might be somebody else out there who has had years where they're up 30%, 20%, 18%, down 5% and up 11% or something like that, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean that one is better than the other, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it all depends on what your benchmark is and what you're trying to accomplish. And this idea that everybody should have the S&P 500 as their benchmark is just, it's completely wrong. You know, very few people should have the S&P 500 as their benchmark.
I couldn't agree more, unless you're running a straight equity all the time portfolio and you know, something right. designed to be that part portion of the portfolio, because it was something we talk about with our clients all the time. And again, I think that this is a core tenet of being a fiduciary and a money manager that has been completely lost, is that your job is for the client to be good regardless of what happens. Right. And so many people are out there and they don't even realize it, but they're trying to thread a needle. If A happens, you're going to be great. We just hope D and E don't show up. Well, what if they do? Right. Yeah. That doesn't work. And you've got to, you know, a good example of that to me is you've been in infinitely more of these than I have. But the crypto bulls. I go out there and I'll tell people, look, I think that crypto's a bubble and I don't think it's going to end well for a variety of different reasons. They're like, oh, you're an idiot. And I go, whoa, hold on. I own some. Right? We've made a lot of money on it.
Yeah.
And now at the same time, I'll flip over to the gold bulls that hear that I own crypto and they rip me apart. And I go, listen, do you know what your portfolio would look like if you would have diversified 5 to 10% of your gold miners into Bitcoin and then used the profits to buy more gold miners? Like your gold miner portfolio would be probably twice as large, three times as large, you know, like it doesn't have to be this binary type thing.
Yeah.
More importantly, Brent, and I don't know if you agree with this, but I think that if you have clients later in life, like I'm sure make up the majority of your and mine, I think it's grossly irresponsible to put them in a binary type of portfolio.
Well, it is. That's another very good example. And that's why I say you have to really understand when you're listening to different people speak or talk about how they would manage a portfolio or the types of investment, you got to understand what their parameters are. Mm-hmm. What they're trying to accomplish, what their parameters are, and the level of risk they're willing to take. And then not only that, but you kind of have to separate what they are talking about with regards to their portfolios that they run, and that may be dramatically different than what they are doing personally in their own account.
It is
Jeff Gundlach, right? Jeff Gundlach runs a big bond fund, right? A U.S. dollar-based bond fund. But, you know, what he's doing, that doesn't mean he has all his money in bonds, right? He probably does a lot of different things as an individual in his personal account than what he's doing. So if you hear him speaking at a conference on a topic of bonds, you know, that doesn't mean, and if you really like what he has to say, that doesn't mean you should go out and put 100% of your money in bonds because Jeff Gundlach gave a good presentation about bonds.
Right. Well, a guy that we've had on the show multiple times too, and I know you know him, Mark Yusko. He's a huge crypto bull, right?
Yep.
I know for a fact Mark has a very broad, diverse portfolio, right? Yeah. He's one of the biggest crypto guys out there. I feel like this parlays great or transitions great into the next thing that I wanted to discuss with you. Obviously, wanted to get into the dollar and get into that because I am very much still in your camp. I am less certain about what we're going to see first, depreciate, you know, the dollar going up or the dollar going down. I am unnerved by the absolute certainty by so many folks out there about the dollar going down.
Yep.
And I also want to get into some misconceptions, and I think this is a pretty good place to start. I hear this all the time, and this is one of the issues that I have with this whole dollar conversation, is I just don't think that there's a lack of understanding. I cannot tell you how many times over the last couple months I've had people in the business and clients, people not in the business, and prospective clients say to me things like, well, Zach, I'm worried about the dollar plummeting in value and markets crashing.
Yeah.
And I went, so guys, that's not how this works, right? If your scenario plays out, you're going to have a lot more money. Now, the spending power of that money might be less.
That's right.
But we're looking about the – we're freaked out about the wrong thing, in my opinion. Don't you? Would you agree?
Right. Yes, exactly.
Right. If their scenario happens, Brent, then everything goes up, man. Right?
That's the thing. That's a hyperinflation is the massive rise in asset prices.
Right.
I mean, everybody thinks of it as a massive fall in the dollar. It's actually, and it is, but that's just that's one way to look at it. But the flip side of it is, which is not any, it doesn't mean it make it any less wrong or any less right, is that it just means asset prices are going up a lot.
Right.
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 And so in that environment, you want to own assets. Now it doesn't, but you don't have to own just one asset. You can own a lot of different assets. You know, if you go look at, Venezuela over the when 5 or 6 years ago when the currency fell dramatically,
they had
the best performing stock market in the world. So the people in Venezuela that owned stocks were a lot better off than the people who were sitting in cash because they were afraid that the stock market was going to crash and the currency was going to fall.
Well,
they would have been better off to be in some other currency altogether. But,
yeah.
Well,
Brent, they would have been better off having a mix of stocks, commodities, crypto, gold. Right. Goes back to our original statement. Here's the other one about the inflationistas out there and the Uber perma dollar bears. Is when you look at that, and I've used the Venezuela situation many times as an example, but when you look at that whole scenario that they're talking about, oh, you're going to see this dollar collapse, and not only does it make asset prices go up, but you know, their argument, gold or crypto or whatever it is, right? They got the one answer to the dollar going down. And yet I think in the last 2 years, we've been given a very good case study of why that's a stupid way to go about it. Meaning, if somebody would have told you that lumber was a really good inflationary hedge 2 years ago, I probably would have laughed. I mean, yeah, sure. Would it benefit from an inflationary environment? Yeah, but you wouldn't think lumber would go 5X, right, or go parabolic.
Right.
And that was kind of a thing that I pointed to and said, look, there is an – inflation is very hard to predict, and it's very hard to predict what assets will respond the most to it because there's other factors at play, right? It may not. You could get a hyperinflationary environment in the United States, and gold may not be the best asset, performing asset in that environment. Right? Isn't that entirely possible?
Absolutely. No question about it.
Okay, so getting into a little bit deeper esoteric policy about it, I've been thinking a lot about the dollar lately, and wondering what the dollar really is at this point. And I had a thought. Because I'm kind of, and bear with me, I'll kind of walk you through the framework, but I'm very much of the belief that we already have a one world currency. Pretty, you know, just everybody's like, well, yeah, we have a reserve currency. And I go, no, truly a one world currency. Now, this is kind of a theory, a framework that I'm working on. You can feel free to poke holes. And I look at the U.S. dollar, and it seems to me that the U.S. dollar has really become the VIX of the currency world, right? I kind of see it as playing that role more so than a traditional currency. And then I look at the swap lines set up, and what is the Fed? I think we had, what did we have? Like 8 swap lines set up with foreign central banks going into the financial crisis. Post the financial crisis, I think we had like 15, and now I think it's up to 30. Does that sound right to you?
That sounds right. I don't have the exact numbers, but that's approximately correct.
Yeah. So then thinking about the way the swap lines play into it, and one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, is our proliferation of swap lines all over the world, is that kind of our version of One Belt, One Road?
Yes, it is. But I would almost say the other way. Like we have been doing the One Belt, One Road for decades.
Yep.
China's One Belt, One Road, or the BRI, however you want to define that, Bridge and Road, initiative. They're copying. They're trying to set up a system that copies what we have done, mm-hmm. right? But yes, I would say that our extension of swap lines is essentially the same thing. Again, you have to understand, and I know I've talked about this before, but it bears repeating because it's extremely important. The main reason that I think the dollar is going to go higher in the years ahead, despite all the quote unquote money printer covert, is that the U.S. is not in a unique situation. If we were the only ones in this fiscal debt trap, for lack of a better word, then I would say, yes, we should allocate our assets somewhere else because the chickens are going to come home to roost in the U.S. The problem is that virtually everywhere else in the world is in the same situation.
Right.
And
or
so
worse.
As a result, everybody's going to have to quote unquote print. So the supply of currency, in my opinion, is not the determining factor because the supply will try to be met by the central authorities. So what it will come down to is demand, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is, whether you like it or not, is there is huge demand for the dollar. Now, that doesn't mean people like having the demand, but the demand is there. I don't like having to pay my taxes at the end of the year, but the demand is there nonetheless, right? I don't like having to service any debt that I owe, but you know what? The demand is there anyway. And the dollar system outside the United States, known as the euro dollar system, is orders of magnitude bigger than the dollar system inside the United States. And so there's an incredible amount of demand for U.S. dollars outside the United States. Now, that same dynamic does not exist for the yen and the euro and the real and the pound and the, the peso, et cetera, et cetera. So there is much, much more demand for dollars than there is on a global basis than there is for any other currency on a global basis. And so I think this whole supply-demand dynamic will come down to the demand part of that, and I think the price will go a lot higher. And it doesn't mean people will like it. It doesn't mean that they wouldn't like another system. It doesn't mean that it's even a good system. It's just the way the system currently is. Now, that can change at some point, and perhaps there are factions out there working to change it. But as of right now, it hasn't changed, and I think it's much harder to change than people think. And here, I want to make one other point on this. I don't want to belabor it too much, but I think it's a very critical point. Because whenever I say what I've just said, the first challenge back is that, yes, but Brent, a lot of these dollars exist out there. They've been loaned all these dollars. They will just default on these loans, and therefore they won't have to pay those dollars anymore. Okay, so there's two parts to this. Number one, if they default on their dollars, that is possible. But there's a couple things that happen there. Number one, at least initially, when somebody defaults, that's not a good sign. Declaring bankruptcy is typically a negative event for whoever declares bankruptcy.
And
so if you default on a loan, your funding costs or the rate at which you can borrow new funds typically rises. So that's not great. The second thing is when you start defaulting on loans in a debt-based monetary system, it typically leads to a credit contraction. And if there's a credit contraction, that means the supply of dollars typically contracts. So therefore, you get into, again, supply-demand dynamics. But the third thing, and this is the thing that most people just don't even realize, I think a lot of people think that when I tell them that there's, $20 or $30 trillion in U.S. dollar loans outside the United States, they think that those were loaned to them by the United States. That is not the case. The euro dollar loans that exist have been lent by entities outside the United States. So
and borrowed by entities outside
the United States. Yes, right. So if the borrowers start defaulting on those dollar loans, they're not defaulting on Wells Fargo in San Francisco. They're not defaulting on Bank of America in Chicago. They're defaulting on, you know, Banco Santander in Spain. You know, they're defaulting on Banco Patrimonial in Brazil. They're defaulting on Mitsubishi in Japan. So, you know, one person's loan or one person's debt is another person's asset. So if they start defaulting on all these loans, yes, they're getting rid of the liability side, but you're killing somebody's assets outside the United States as well.
You're destroying capital.
You're destroying capital. So this idea that they can just walk away from the dollar, that means they're walking away from one of their biggest assets. It's not impossible. Things happen all the time. You should probably be prepared for it, and you should probably understand the reasons why it could happen, but you shouldn't go all in on it. Because it's possible, and I would even say probable, that it's not going to work out the way most people think.
No. And you and I have talked about this before. The other thing that always brings me back, and as a matter of fact, this was actually how you and I met, was me reaching out to you based on hearing an interview, because you were the only other guy, and I felt like I was nuts talking about, you know, I was not out there actively talking about it, certainly nowhere close to the magnitude you were. But the first time I heard you talk, I sat there and I went, holy smokes, this is the only other guy I know that maybe I'm not completely nuts. And the thing I kept going back to, and I still do to this day when looking at this topic, is, you know, every time in every scenario, every market I've ever looked at, when you identify an Achilles heel or a weak spot, it is certain that that will give at some point. You can't ever determine when that exactly will be, but that weak spot eventually always breaks or always gets pressed, right? Yeah. And when I look at the world today, that apocalyptic outcome is a DXY at 120 or 130 or 140,
that's
or
right,
God forbid, higher. It's not the DXY going down 25%. It's just not.
That's exactly right. And here's the other thing is, and I think a lot of the people who push back on my argument that the dollar's going higher, there's two things. There's two pushbacks. One is that they will say, yes, Brent, maybe the dollar goes up versus other fiat currencies, but that doesn't mean that it won't be going down versus gold or other real assets. And my answer is, you're absolutely right. You should own some gold and you should own some other assets, but you shouldn't necessarily own it just because you think the dollar is going to fall, because it's very possible that the dollar is going to rise dramatically versus other fiat currencies. And then they say, well, but that just won't matter. And I would say it absolutely matters. The fiat dollar rising versus other fiat currencies has huge implications for markets. And if you don't believe me, just go back and look at every crisis, look at every financial crisis for the last 30 years and look and see what the dollar index did during those crises. And if you can find one where the dollar fell during a crisis, let me know, because I'd like to see it. And then the other thing that I think people don't quite get, well, it's sort of related to this, is that part of the reason they will push back when I say the dollar's going to rise is because they're absolutely convinced that everything that the Fed and the other central banks are doing is going to be inflationary. And the reality is you can have inflation with the dollar rising. Now, a lot of people, that's just fundamentally impossible to them, but it actually can happen. You know, if you get cost push inflation where prices are rising because supply is constrained and the dollar is right, you know, if the dollar is rising and putting pressure on economies and corporations, and as a result, some businesses go out of business, and as a result, the supply of those things that company was providing is constrained. Well, now you have, you know, price going up because supply is constrained, even though we're in a slowdown. that's stagflation to a certain extent, right?
Well, you could make it, Brent, isn't that kind of, aren't we seeing, I don't mean to cut you off, but to echo your point, aren't we seeing that right now in the sense that you've got a 5.1 CPI print and you've got the DXY at 93?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly where I'm going with this. And so for the people who don't think that you can see the dollar rising versus other fiat currencies and have inflation, go look and see where the dollar index was in 2008 prior to the financial crisis. It was around 80 or 85. Actually, I think it was in the 70s. Well, now it's in the 90s. You know, think of all the money that's been quote unquote printed for the last 13, 14 years.
Yeah, what were we at? 60? Yeah, I think we were at 63% debt to GDP prior to the financial crisis. Now we're knocking on 150, and the DXY index has rallied 25% during that period of time.
Exactly. The other thing is, you know, if I asked a room of people, how many people think that money printing, what the Fed is doing, will cause the dollar to fall? And, you know, most people in the room will raise their hand.
Yep.
Well, in the last 12 months, the Fed has quote unquote monetized or printed, however you want to define this, about $1.5 trillion. Take $100 billion a month, you know, for 12 months, and you know, I think it's 120 they're doing. You know, you get to about 1.5 trillion. But over the last 12 months, the dollar's flat. Well, if they printed $1.5 trillion, shouldn't that be negative for the dollar? Why hasn't the dollar continued to fall? And so my point is it's important to understand conceptually why things happen, but it's also important to go and check the facts to see whether that's actually happening or not. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, the point is your cost of living can rise. In other words, your cost of living inflation can go up, but it can go up along with the dollar going higher. And I think that's, you know, that's very possibly what we see in the years ahead.
Yeah, well, Brent, I think this is a good learning opportunity for people out there, especially the people out there that are listening to us going, no, eventually the chickens come home to roost and you guys are idiots. You're just being naive. The dollar is going to collapse. To those people, I would just say, listen, please just for your own good, just take a second and listen to us, because I think you and I have this in common from our previous conversations. But I want people to realize that I came to this conclusion by being a bigger dollar bear than anybody I knew, right? My belief that gold was the asset you had to hold and that the dollar was going to collapse coming out of the financial crisis is literally. So I've made the argument before, and I think you and I have discussed this on air before, that the people, the dollar bears, that's like the double A ball for being dollar bearish. Once you become a dollar bull, that's the major leagues of being a real dollar bear, right? Because right. And I think your journey was similar, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'd like you to answer that. And then I want to throw one more thing at you, before I forget to bring it up, cause I know we're a little pressed on time, but I wanted to also talk about how swap lines impact this. And I wanted to play, kind of go a little bit end game-ish on there to see where we see that going. So first of all, getting back to that first question I asked you, and then I wanted to get into swap lines and ask you a couple more follow-on questions there.
Yeah. So what was the first question again? Just make sure I'm not jumping around.
You know what, Brent? I'm not sure that I remember what the first question was. Let's. So we can move right into the swap lines things. What were you just going to say?
Well, I was just going to say that the way the swap lines work is that what people have to understand is that it's not just a one way thing. Swap lines is not the United States printing dollars, sending them over to Europe, and letting Europe just have them. It just doesn't work that.
Right.
It just doesn't work that way. It's a loan. We loan dollars to the ECB. The ECB then goes to their constituent central banks and loans those central banks dollars. And then those central banks go to their corporations in their countries and loan dollars to those corporations. Those loans have to be paid back. So what they're doing is, when you get a loan for a dollar, what happens at the end of the year? You have to pay interest on that loan, right? You have to pay that dollar off. That is demand for dollars. So the extension of swap lines, while it may ease dollar pressure in the very short term, it actually reinforces dollar as the global reserve currency because it increases the demand for it. Does that make sense?
Brent, yeah, no, I totally get you. But one of the things I've thought about is, and this may not even be legal, although I'm less constrained by legality than I used to be when I saw what the Federal Reserve pulled off with corporate bonds last March. So, and I don't want to get into that, but but what if they took the swap lines, kind of going back to this being our version of One Belt One Road? What if they took the swap lines and fixed the exchange rates on them, so that the exchange rates on the swap lines were fixed? I mean, wouldn't we really be a one world currency at that point?
Yeah, I mean, we probably would be at that point. And that, again, that would enhance the dollar as the global reserve currency, right? And what I would say is that all pegs, all these financial pegs, all these, you know, the setting of interest rates, the this or the that, they're all manipulations, right? And eventually, all pegs break. It doesn't matter what the peg is. Eventually, market forces overpower what the central banks or what the monetary authorities have come up with. And whether doing that could stabilize, for lack of a better word, the system for 9 months, 9 years? Yeah, possibly. But at some point, you know, the central planning, you know, Rube Goldberg machine that they built is going to break.
Yeah.
And my point is when the system breaks, that's when you sell the stuff. You don't get to sell the stuff you want to sell. You sell the stuff you have to sell, and you don't buy the stuff you want to buy. You buy the stuff you have to buy. And when that happens, as we saw in March 2020, it is my belief that despite the fact that they may hate selling assets and buying dollars, that is what the world will have to do. And I think that will push the dollar higher, because I think they will have to buy dollars before they have to buy euros, or before they have to buy yen, or before they have to buy reals, or whatever it is, or in greater numbers. They'll have to buy those currencies too, but I think they'll have to buy dollars in greater numbers. And as a result, I think the demand pushes the dollar higher. Now, even if you don't think that this is the base case, I would just, again, encourage you to go and look and see the types of market dislocations that have happened when the dollar has risen versus other fiat currencies. And, you know, even if you don't think it's likely, I would highly suggest you should think about having some kind of an insurance policy against that happening, just in case it does.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that seems like it would certainly make sense. Now, here in the final couple of minutes that we've got, what has COVID done to your thesis, and where does it push us? Has it sped up, in your opinion? Does it bring it closer, that period of time where the dollar, you know, again, using your framework, where the dollar is going to explode higher? Has it pushed it off? What has been the impact on this?
Yeah, so this is a great question, and it brings up something that I think I'm glad you asked it, because it allowed me to kind of address something. And again, I'm not sure to the extent your listeners here have heard me talk before or are familiar with, you know, kind of my evolutionary theory on the dollar here. But I often get criticized for being so stubborn and stuck in my ways and unwilling to entertain another possible outcome, right? On the flip side, whenever I do slightly change my mind or make adjustments due to market environments, then I get accused of moving the goalposts or kicking out the time frame. So the reality is that no matter what you do in this business, you just can't win, right? Unless you absolutely perfectly nail the trade, you're always going to be accused of being wrong by somebody.
Oh, yeah.
But when I think we can all agree, whether, again, without getting too conspiratorial, right, regardless of whether you think the COVID is the worst thing in history, or if you think it's actually not that bad and it's all a conspiracy, whether you think that what the government has done is correct, or whether you think it's not correct, if you just completely throw the opinion on it out the window and just sit back and say, has COVID dramatically impacted the world around you? I think the absolutely overwhelming answer is yes, right?
Okay. Absolutely.
So if I don't feel too bad about changing my thesis a little bit or kicking out the time frame a little bit because COVID showed up, right? If I'm going to, if there's going to be some excuse to change your thesis a little bit, I think COVID warrants, you know, being one of those things. Now, with that said, I don't really think that it has changed my overall thesis, other than I think it has extended the game. When it initially happened, I actually thought it was going to speed it up, right?
Yeah.
I thought, and because I thought, you know, we were going to have this, the shutting down of the economy would absolutely shut down, you know, money circulating, right?
Yeah.
And what we knew that they would provide supply. We knew the central banks would come in and provide supply. What we did not anticipate, or at least perhaps did not anticipate to the extent that they've been able to do, was their ability to defer demand for dollars. And what I mean by that is not only did they do PPP loans to provide supply, not only did they do QE to provide supply, but they also said, oh, you know what, your rent, you don't need to pay it. Oh, you know what, your mortgage, you don't need to pay it. Oh, emerging markets, all that dollar debt you owe, you don't need to pay it that's coming due. You can roll that out another year or two, right?
Yeah.
So they didn't get rid of demand, but they deferred demand. And as a result, it kicked everything down the road, right? Now, I initially, and that's what we got wrong. We knew supply would be added. We didn't fully appreciate the extent to which they could defer demand effectively. So, you know, and as a result, you know, but and I don't think that they can do that forever, right? Now, you know, those rent moratoriums are starting to, come due, right? People are going to have to start paying rent again. You know, people are going to have to start paying their mortgages.
And at higher rates.
You know, and at higher, you know, so we think that it's still going to play out, but there's no question that they have done a very good job of extending this game longer than we initially thought possible. But here's the other thing I would say is that we knew going in it was very unlikely that we could time this perfectly, right? And as a result, we told our clients and the people who kind of came to us looking for advice around this is not something that you should go 100% on. We actually think you should only put 5% of your portfolio into something like, you know, into some of these quote unquote dollar trades.
Right.
You know, and we could very well be wrong or we could very well be wrong for a couple of years before we get it right. You know, so while even if it takes a couple more years to play out now, that's fine. We always thought it would be a 3 or 4 year trade anyway. And if as a result of COVID it becomes 4 or 5 year trade, then so be it. You know, the types of trades that we're doing in our quote unquote, you know, fund that's, you know, specifically geared towards a rapidly rising dollar, those are very asymmetric trades. You don't have to put your whole portfolio in it to do really well. To your point earlier, if you just put a little bit of your money in crypto, you would have done very well, right? It's
yep.
kind of the same thing here. You can put a little bit of money in. If you lose, doesn't kill you, but if you get it right, you know, it has a meaningful impact on your portfolio.
And I think now more than ever, that type of thinking is horrifically needed. And as is usually the case, what's needed the most is had the least, right? And
sure.
I just based on all the stuff that we're looking at, that you're talking about, if you're an investor out there, look, you know, certainty sells. I get it. Yeah, everybody wants to find the guy that's got the secret. Well, he doesn't exist. And you need to be prepared for your portfolio and your life to be okay regardless of what happens. Because if you're honest and you know what's happening, I think the one thing we all know is that we have no clue how this plays out. Right?
Yeah.
So,
yep.
Well, hey, pal, you've been
anybody that tells you that they know how this is going to play out, you know, turn around and run the other way.
Well,
that includes me. That includes me. If you hear me say something and you think that I'm absolutely certain, you know, that doesn't mean you should put 100% of your portfolio in it.
Well, there's this guy I know that developed these quads, though, and he's never wrong.
He's never wrong.
No. Yeah, he's 100. That's been interesting watching that one unfold. I don't want to go down that one, but boy, what a trip that cat is. Anyway, well, hey, pal, as always, thank you so much for joining us. And it's been fun to be able to dig into this stuff with you. And as always, if anything interesting pops up and you want to join us, man, you're always welcome. And the folks can follow you at Santiago Cap, no, at Santiago AU Fund, right? Isn't that the...
That's right. That's me on Twitter. You can just search for Santiago Capital. You can go to YouTube and type in, you know, Brett Johnson, Santiago Capital, and you'll get all kinds of different hits and links and stuff. So always happy to come here and talk to you, Zach. Hope you have a great weekend.
All right, buddy. You too. Take care. All right, you guys. Well, unfortunately, that wraps it up for today, but we will be back with another deep dive session next week. Got another good one lined up for you. Have a fantastic weekend. We will see you next week. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.